From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The Florida legislature is poised for this year's session, but for one state agency in particular, this session is truly all about the Benjamins.
We're given a certain amount of money, and then we run everybody through that algorithm, and out the other side comes, this is the amount that you get.
Also this week, Visit Florida could stop operating this summer unless lawmakers make a change. But not all state leaders think the Tourism Development Agency is necessary.
We think we've got such a great quality of life and so many amenities and values that people are going to come here.
We'll also find that another state's experience with medical marijuana may provide insights into Florida's future on the issue. I'm Tom Flanagan, and on this week before session, welcome to Capitol Report. We say it every year before Florida lawmakers descend on Tallahassee for the lawmaking session. The state budget is the only thing they absolutely positively have to pass in the course of the 60-day get-together. So regardless of all the other sound and fury that may emanate from the hallowed halls of the Capitol, it's all secondary to the prime directive of passing a spending plan to keep state government functioning more or less efficiently and effectively. In the upcoming months, Florida lawmakers will grapple with a decision, though, how to stabilize the budget of one of its health care agencies. The Agency for Persons with Disabilities has run deficits in most years since it was created in the early 2000s. Lawmakers have become increasingly frustrated about constantly having to backfill those deficits. But Lynn Hatter reports advocates are concerned over which chamber will get final say over how the agency moves forward.
When Hurricane Michael struck North Florida last year, it devastated parts of the panhandle and left tens of thousands of people homeless, powerless, and waterless. Amanda Baker is one of them. After Michael, she came to Tallahassee from Panama City.
Because I was critically ill at that time, I had been without electricity and water for 7 days.
Baker uses a wheelchair, and she relies on caregivers to help her throughout the day.
So I have to have personal care every day, and they have to come in and help me bathe and help me get dressed, fix my food.
That help is funded through Medicaid. The money is sorted out by the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. Baker and nearly 35,000 other Floridians depend on that funding to keep them out of institutions and in their own homes and communities. But the agency has consistently overspent its budget due to state underfunding and federal program requirements. Agency Secretary Barbara Palmer says APD is in a catch-22.
The state plan says you have to stay within appropriation. The federal government says, regardless of your appropriation, you have to fund these people. So what do? You know, that's why we are where we are.
There are about 21,000 people on a waiting list for services, and those services are for life. Tallahassee's Amanda Baker has had her services since she was 3. Today, she's 39 and vice president of the Florida Developmental Disabilities Council. It advises the governor and legislature on policy, and it has some advice of its own. In order to get costs under control, the legislature should move APD into its Social Services Estimating Committee to, well, estimate future costs.
We believe that this would be helpful in realistic expectations and expenditure amounts.
APD Secretary Barbara Palmer says there are also problems with how funding is doled out.
But what happens in the algorithm is this. We're given a certain amount of money, and then we run everybody through that algorithm, and out the other side comes, this is the amount that you get. What we found is it's not always what you need, it's what you get.
Florida lawmakers ordered the Agency for Healthcare Administration and APD to come up with a list of recommendations to contain costs. The agencies submitted their list in September. Bottom line, give APD more money. Florida is last in the nation when it comes to funding for disability services. Yet, what may be more important is what's not included in their recommendations, privatizing the program.
But I understand that this redesign request came from the House, and it was specifically to be looking at managed care. And I know that the House has been looking at it. The Senate has been very helpful in not having that happen over the years. We want to keep that from happening.
Vin Sequienzia is president emeritus of the Autism Society of Florida. The state has privatized most of its Medicaid program, shifting people to managed care and letting private healthcare companies administer it. ACA oversees most of the system, with the exception of the people served by APD. The Florida House has expressed interest in using managed care with people with developmental disabilities, a move that alarms disability rights advocates who say those private insurers aren't able to handle the type of caregiving and independent living services disabled Floridians rely on. And during a recent presentation to reporters, Governor Ron DeSantis was asked about the APD's funding future.
I think it's been a tough issue fiscally, but I think it's an issue where, you know, some of these folks are in pretty bad shape, and we have a responsibility to do what we can. So I'm very open about the best way forward. I'm not saying one or the other.
The worry? If the House gets its way, people will likely lose services, not gain them. I'm Lynn Hatter in Tallahassee.
It's not only health care that could face some serious defunding over the next few months. The future of Florida's tourism arm is likely to play a central role this legislative session. Regan McCarthy reports, while some say Visit Florida is essential to maintaining one of the state's biggest industries, others argue advertising for private businesses isn't the government's job.
Visit Florida's partnership with the state will sunset in July of this year unless lawmakers do something to stop that from happening.
What this bill does is it reauthorizes Visit Florida for until October 1 of 2028. This does not attach any dollars to their budget. This is a reauthorization. Without this bill passing on July 1 of this coming year, Visit Florida will go away forever.
That's Palm Harbor Republican Senator Ed Hooper. He says tourism plays a key role in the state's economy.
Tourism is vital to this state. In 2018, 127 million people visited this state from out of state, generating $85.9 billion to our economy.
Hooper says Visit Florida is a big reason for those numbers, but House Speaker Jose Oliva argues that's not true.
What we found in the last couple of years was a great deal of that money was not even really being used to promote Florida. So whatever amount of money was being used to promote Florida was not having a direct correlation on tourism.
The organization's CEO, Dana Young, says the proof can be found by looking at what's happened in other states.
The state of Colorado did something similar many years ago. They defunded their tourism marketing agency. They lost billions of dollars. It took them 20 years to recover.
Another issue is funding for the agency. Hooper's renewal bill doesn't come with any money attached. Last legislative session, after House leaders pushed to axe the agency, Governor Ron DeSantis stepped in and lawmakers allocated $50 million for Visit Florida. It was such a significant cut that it caused the agency to reduce its staff by a third. Hooper says the current funding level isn't enough.
My own personal opinion, it is not, but the executive director of Visit Florida has already made those painful cuts, and she would be more than happy to continue at that same level funding.
But even that money isn't guaranteed. House Budget Chair, Orange Park Republican Representative Travis Cummings, says the House remains unconvinced the state's tourism industry will suffer without a state-funded agency to bolster it.
Hey, tourism, as was outlined here today, is extremely important. Do spending taxpayer dollars result in more tourists coming here? We think we've got such a great quality of life and so many amenities and values that people are going to come here.
Cummings says funding Visit Florida is a year-to-year decision that will depend on what other priorities or needs come up as lawmakers hammer out a spending plan. If lawmakers don't authorize an extension, Visit Florida could stop operating this year. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, multiple criminal justice bills are teed up for legislative consideration starting next week.
I think it's critically important that we put those dollars back into our system to educate people and prepare them to go home.
After banning sanctuary cities, lawmakers turned their attention to a federal worker verification system.
I think the best way to help deter illegal immigration is to pursue E-Verify.
Florida's medical marijuana landscape has been in a state of flux for years and may continue to be fluid if the example of Illinois is any indicator.
Perhaps adding, you know, a couple licenses for companies that just want to open dispensaries or, you know, just want to open growing facilities.
And it wouldn't be an election year without at least a few so-called culture war issues making their way into legislative debate.
The people who do get up and speak and everybody stops to listen, those are the people that have influence.
A slew of criminal justice reform bills will be up in this year's legislative session. Ryan Daly reports a number of them will get a hearing during the first week lawmakers return to Tallahassee.
House and Senate criminal justice committees will meet Tuesday and Wednesday. Up for consideration are a number of proposals that have criminal justice advocates talking. One that will get a hearing in the Senate Tuesday would expand criminal record expungement for minors. It's sponsored by Republican Senator Keith Perry. As it stands, there is a process for expungement of record if a minor completes a diversion program, though it's limited to first-time misdemeanor offenses. Democratic Senator Jason Pizzo is also carrying a bill dealing with expungement of criminal records.
Senate Bill 684 members allows for a court-ordered expunction to be granted to an individual whose previous court-ordered expunction was granted prior to the age of 18.
That will be up in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday, the bill's second stop. Senate Criminal Justice Committee Chair Jeff Brandis already has bills moving. Five of them were passed by the panel during its meeting in December. Senate Bill 572 would expand the definition of confinement in the Department of Corrections for gain time purposes. It would include time spent in the department's care, custody, supervision, or control through participation in a program.
There's currently no data to suggest that $50 in a bus pass is the best way to release an inmate. This bill authorizes the Department of Corrections to allow an inmate to participate in a supervised community release program up to 365 days before their technical release date.
In its first committee stop, the bill was amended by Democratic Senator Randolph Bracey of Orange County to include a gain time provision. That's something Brandis advocated for last session, to reduce a state requirement that the incarcerated must serve 85% of their sentence, even with time earned, to 65%.
This amendment allows nonviolent offenders to earn more incentive gain time for good behavior, diligent work, educational attainment, and other constructive programming by lowering the 85% threshold to 65%, and for it to be applied retroactively. As the Secretary has stated numerous times, our current model is unsustainable, and I believe we have no choice but to lower the threshold for gain time.
Bracey also has his own standalone gain time bill. Greg Newburn is Policy Director for advocacy group Families Against Mandatory Minimums Florida. He supports Brandis's measure.
The 85% requirement says they have to be in confinement. This would expand what confinement means, so it would allow folks to just serve their time in different, more productive ways.
In the House, Tampa Democratic Representative Diane Hart is carrying a proposal similar to Bracey's. Last April, state estimators said a gain time provision could take more than 9,000 people out of the prison population by 2023. Estimators also said it could potentially save the state as much as $860 million. Representative Hart says those savings are a bonus on top of the problems allowing for additional gain time could alleviate in an ailing prison system.
Not only do we get people to go home earlier, we also get to save over $800 million over a five-year period, which I think is critically important that we put those dollars back into our system to educate people and prepare them to go home.
Another Brandis bill that's cleared its first hurdle in the Senate is one that looks to let elderly inmates out of prison who have served at least 10 years of their sentence. It would apply to inmates at least 70 years old who were not convicted of certain violent and sexual offenses. Gene Greason is director for Men of the Word Prison Ministry. He visits incarcerated men who oftentimes have to live in conditions he describes as being tough on even younger inmates. He described visiting a prison on a particularly cold night where inmates were sleeping in sub-60 degree weather indoors.
If you've ever attempted to sleep in a 56 degree room with one of your clothes and sheets, you'd know what I'm talking about.
He asked lawmakers to consider dropping the age even lower for inmates to qualify.
In summary, I'm asking that you change this bill to make the age 65 instead of 70.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 15% of the country's prison population in 2016 were 65 years old or older. Criminal justice bills are still being filed ahead of the session's start date. A recent Brandeis bill would lessen the mandatory minimum sentences for designated prison releasee reoffenders by about a third. Under Florida's prison releasee reoffender law, a person can be sentenced as such if they commit certain crimes, most of them violent crimes, within 3 years of being released from a detention facility if their original sentence was a prison sentence. I'm Ryan Daly.
Florida lawmakers banned sanctuary cities for undocumented immigrants last year. Now Governor Ron DeSantis wants all employers to use the federal E-Verify system to make sure their workers are legally eligible to work in the United States. Previous efforts requiring private employers to use E-Verify have failed in Florida, and Gina Jordan tells us Republican lawmakers are trying again.
Governor Ron DeSantis signed a hotly debated bill in June that bans sanctuary cities in Florida. Months later, the bill's sponsor, Sarasota Republican Senator Joe Gruters, joined the governor before a crowd in the Villages to praise the legislation.
We're not anti-immigrant. We're anti-illegal immigrant. And now, as of today, all 67 counties in the entire state have enacted the sanctuary city ban, and they're complying and they're cooperating with federal authorities. It works.
Gruters is also behind a new bill requiring businesses to use E-Verify. DeSantis says it's a good next step for immigration reform.
We had a big win with doing the sanctuary cities legislation. We want to build off that momentum. I think the best way to help deter illegal immigration is to pursue E-Verify.
DeSantis believes E-Verify will lead to higher wages because employers will no longer be able to hire undocumented workers on the cheap. Jacksonville Beach Republican Representative Cord Byrd agrees. He plans to file an E-Verify bill in the House.
Illegal labor impacts the wages of everybody and drives those wages down. So as we're talking about trying to increase wages in so many areas, this is one way that we can impact that.
Byrd's bill will likely be similar to one already filed in the Senate that would require all businesses to use the federal database to verify employment eligibility. Senate Democratic Leader Audrey Gibson isn't a fan.
The sponsors of the E-Verify bill are apparently, presumably, trying to deliver on campaign promise by the governor and a campaign promise by the White House without regard to detriment to families.
Gibson says the bill isn't needed, and it could have a chilling effect on a workforce that helps boost Florida's economy, like farmers and hospitality workers. Florida's agriculture, tourism, and construction industries have long expressed concerns about E-Verify and have fiercely opposed attempts by the legislature to require it. Senate President Bill Galvano is on their side. He says the mandate creates an extra burden for employers.
There are challenges or issues that have been raised by many of our job creators in the state of Florida, from the tourist industry to the ag community.
Under the Senate bill, employers would lose all applicable licenses to do business if they don't register with the E-Verify system. House Speaker Jose Oliva hasn't weighed in on whether he'll support the legislation. I'm Gina Jordan.
A 2017 law challenging Florida's medical marijuana industry plays a big part over what may happen with medical or recreational marijuana in Florida this session. The lawsuit is being brought by FloraGrown, a Tampa-based firm, which was denied a license from the state. Capitol reporter Blaise Ganey speaks with Cannabis Wire's Sean Mulcahy about the current status of that case and the impact it could have on the upcoming session.
You know a lot about Florida cannabis and the laws going on here. Can you sort of talk about the framework that it's in right now and sort of what's being challenged in court?
Yeah, so the FloraGrown case really hinges on two separate issues. The first is the number of licenses. So the original legislation that passed capped the number of licenses that were available to people. And originally, the first round, where the only people who were eligible were people who had previously applied for low THC licenses, which were, you know, back in, I believe it was 2016 was when that passed. But the first real issue hinges on the number of available licenses. So the floor grown is challenging that, saying that it's unconstitutionally limiting the amount of providers. Then the second issue hinges on a single word. So in the amendment that passed that legalized adult use marijuana, recreational marijuana, it said that it defined a medical marijuana treatment center as an entity that did any one of a number of things, including possessing, cultivating, distributing, selling, and it used the word or in between those. Meanwhile, when the legislature passed the bill, which lawmakers were authorized to do under the amendment, they passed an implementing bill, which kind of put the law into practice. They clarified that a medical marijuana treatment center must be vertically integrated. In other words, controlling every aspect from seed to sale. So rather than having like a horizontally integrated license where an MMTC or medical marijuana treatment center would control one aspect, just growing or just distributing, they have to control every aspect in the supply chain. And that's really the two issues that Floor Grown is challenging. And it's the case before the Supreme Court.
Gotcha. And so, and you're now in Chicago where marijuana just became legal there on New Year's Day. How's the system set up there?
Yeah, so in Illinois, we have a cultivation license and then we have a distribution license. So there are certain facilities, mostly in downstate Illinois and more rural areas, where they have the cultivation license. So they're big grow facilities where they grow the cannabis. And then we have distribution licenses or dispensary licenses. And then just recently with this adult use law that took effect on January 1st, there's a new type of license called a transport license, which basically is, you know, trucking or transporting marijuana between, you know, the facilities.
So there it's more broken up than in Florida. And because of things that have come out in court saying that the current law in Florida is unconstitutional, it could be moving more towards a way similar to how you either have it in Illinois or in other places like Colorado or California. What do you think Florida is going to be pushing forward?
Yeah, so I do know that State Representative Anthony Sabatini did file a bill that would basically negate the court case. So it removes the license cap and it removes the vertical integration requirement. But I've heard that that bill really doesn't have a chance of passing, especially in the Florida House, which tends to be more conservative than the other chamber of the Senate. But I think that regardless of whether the state Supreme Court moves on this case before the legislative session ends, I think that we could see lawmakers, potentially Senator Brandis, filing a bill that might not completely open up the market. In other words, just scrapping the vertical integration requirement, the seed to sale requirement, but perhaps adding, you know, a couple licenses for companies that just want to open dispensaries or, you know, just want to open growing facilities.
That was Capitol reporter Blaise Gainey and Cannabis Wire's Sean Mulcahy. The bottom line of the conversation, whether done by a lawmaker or the courts, Florida's medical marijuana licensing scheme could see some significant changes. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, parental consent for abortion, LGBTQ rights, and conversion therapy are three culture war issues vying to be heard during the 2020 legislative session. We get that story from Robbie Gaffney.
Emotions can run high when social issues are discussed during session, whether it's abortion.
To regulate murder is to keep murder legal.
LGBTQ rights.
We've heard so much about transgendered bathrooms that I want to know if that's what this whole opposition is about here.
Or banning conversion therapy, just getting a hearing on these issues can be as important to getting them passed. Lakeland Republican Senator Kelly Stargell's bill would require parental or guardian consent for anyone under 18 to have an abortion. During a November Senate hearing, Stargell explains why she's backed the bill.
I thought for sure my mother would kill me when I told her that I was pregnant underage. It was a wonderful time in our relationship when I did tell my mother that I was pregnant.
Stargell says talking to her mother about the pregnancy made their bond stronger.
I have other family members who didn't do that. They went on and had the abortion, and there's been a forever wedge in that relationship.
Her bill is slated to be heard again on the first day of legislative session. The House version is heading to the floor. But other social issues like LGBTQ rights are rarely heard. For 11 years, lawmakers have been trying to pass measures banning discrimination against LGBTQ people. Doing so would grant them protections in the workplace, housing, and more. But despite growing support for these efforts, they've only been heard twice. Catherine DiPaolo Gould is faculty at Florida International University. She studied the Florida legislature for the past 15 years and explains how the process works.
The legislature in Florida is very top-down. It's very centralized. So whatever leadership wants, whatever the Speaker of the House wants or the Senate President finds as their priority, and sometimes what the governor finds as a priority, right, become everything that the legislature discusses.
Republicans hold the majority in Florida's legislature. But for at least 6 years, there's been a Republican sponsor on bills prohibiting discrimination against LGBTQ people. DiPaolo Gould says even with that support, the measure will be a tough sell unless someone influential within the Republican caucus decides to back it.
The people who do get up and speak and everybody stops to listen, those are the people that have influence. And they might not be getting this media coverage, right? They may not have that leadership position. They may not be that committee chairperson. But what they say becomes important.
Last year, Florida Republican Chairman Senator Joe Gruters did back a bill banning workplace discrimination against LGBTQ people. But Gruters drew criticism for his measure not going far enough. It didn't have protections for housing and public accommodations. On the other hand, bills banning conversion therapy have never been heard by the legislature. This year's proposal bans professional counselors and anyone who regulates the practice of medicine from using conversion therapy on minors. The American Mental Health Counselors Association defines the practice as seeking to change someone's sexual orientation. It also tries to change someone's gender identity. Aaron Norton is president of the association's Florida branch.
I don't view it as an ethical practice, and additionally, I don't think it's possible to do.
The American Psychiatric Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and other medical associations oppose the practice. John Stemberger is CEO of the Florida Family Policy Council. He says conversion therapy isn't being practiced.
So it's really not a thing. It's kind of an ideological term that's attempting to loop ordinary counseling care into abusive practices.
For Stemberger, if a patient walks into a counselor's office and asks for such services, that's counseling. But to Norton, that's conversion therapy.
For me personally, I wouldn't be able to help a client with a choice like that to try and change their sexual orientation.
Both the LGBTQ rights and conversion therapy ban bills are not scheduled to be heard despite growing support. There's also efforts to repeal language from Florida law that defines marriage as only between a man and a woman. In 2015, a state and federal ruling allowed same-sex couples to get married in Florida, making the language unconstitutional. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Gainey, Robbie Gaffney, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Starting next Tuesday, January 14th, Capitol Report will be produced every weekday for the duration of the lawmaking session. So please join us for that on many of these Florida public radio stations for daily reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.